The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 16th of September 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's programme, after a week of successes for Ukraine's military, we look at reports of a mass grave outside of the city of Izium and what we know so far. Plus we head to the ancient city of Samarkand in Uzbekistan, where Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russia's President Vladimir Putin will meet on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit. And then to Brazil, where a new poll gives us a hint of what to expect in the country's upcoming presidential race. Plus,
we learned that a well-loved amusement jetty in Southwold had shuttered, possibly submitting to peer pressure.
Monocle's Andrew Muller gives us his take on a mournful week. All that plus the latest business headlines right here on The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. First to Ukraine, where hundreds of graves have been found outside of the city of Izium, just days after Ukrainian troops recaptured it from Russia. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky said the site contained almost 450 bodies. The UN has already said they will send human rights monitors to the scene. In other news, President Zelensky has announced that Ukraine's military had recaptured almost the entire region of Kharkiv. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg did, however, warn that this still doesn't signal the beginning of the end of the war. Joining me to discuss all this is Lara Roslitsky, founder of Black Trident, a defense and security consulting group in Ukraine. Good afternoon to you, Lara.
Good afternoon, Mark.
Could you first tell us what exactly the Ukrainian troops found from Izium? What had happened there and who were these 450 people whose bodies have been found?
Well, mass graves with tortured, mutilated bodies, bodies that have been torn apart by shrapnel, by rockets, also bodies with clear, hideous markings of torture and criminal bodily abuse and harm. The situation that we have here is something that the world should be preparing to see more of as Ukraine continues to liberate its territories. Everybody has heard of Bucha and Irpin, and I believe that it has been an error to focus simply on those territories. And now we have Izium as another exponent of the criminality and violence that the Russians are committing against civilians in Ukraine.
And obviously it's very important to document all that. When Ukrainian troops recapture more territory, what is the procedure to piece together a full picture of what has been happening there under Russian control? And if war crimes, for example, have been committed, what is the procedure exactly?
Well, first, the areas have to be cleared and stabilized because mines and illegal weaponry are used. So the territories are extremely dangerous for any type of forces to come in. Then the Ukrainian police forces come into the territories accompanied by their international partners. Ukraine has, at this point in time, a really complicated international system of observers, monitors, gathering information for the upcoming or planned a special tribunal against the Russians as well as for the international court. The United Nations is extremely slow in moving and actually making accounts or making accounts of the dead and the missing civilians as well as the killed military. And it is incredibly sad and frustrating to see that while in Ukraine, we have the numbers that in Mariupol, for instance, over 83,000 civilians have been slaughtered by the Russians, the UN is still fixing on a number of around 3,000, 3,500 people. So they need to move a little bit quicker, but the process is extremely cumbersome and dangerous.
Why do you think that is? Why is the UN so slow?
It's a lot of red tape and having agreement on the access that the Russians are clearly not giving the United Nations, because the Russians are every day becoming more and more powerful in destroying the international legal and institutional order. So a little bit more integrity is required and toughness from the representatives of these organizations.
Looking at some other related news, Ukrainian troops have obviously been making significant advances. Lara, what is the situation in the Kharkiv region at the moment? How much of it does Ukraine control now?
Well, almost the entire oblast of Kharkiv is under Ukrainian control. There are spots where the Russians are still fighting, and the use of drones is continuing in that territory. So when we hear the Secretary General of NATO mention that we should not be celebrating and this is not a sign that the war is coming to an end, we must take heed to his actions and understand that Russia is currently maneuvering thousands of additional reinforcements into the territory of Ukraine, alongside the Kadyrovites, which use also radical Islamic members from all over the Middle East. We have the Syrian component and the North Korean component on top of it all, with the Iranians sending in these super killer drones. And their drone systems are causing extreme damage, not only to Ukraine's military power, but actually killing a human being. So anti-drone systems is something that Ukraine should also be hoping to receive. And the companies who have them know who they are and should really be making an effort to cooperate with Ukraine.
Are you optimistic at all? Do you think Ukraine's success may help it to get that extra support Ukraine needs from the West?
It's very difficult to be optimistic, but we have no choice, because if we're not optimistic, that means that we are going to succumb to the fear and allow Russian black material empire to take over our values and principles, and not only in Ukraine, but in all peace-loving countries. So, and there is a little bit of hope when we see Rammstein and Copenhagen groups really looking at how they can cooperate. Everybody's waiting for Lend-Lease to kick in quickly. So the good versus evil narrative is very real, and the good has to win. There's no choice.
Just finally, Lara, what is your impression of how the Russian troops are acting at the moment? How much chaos is there, or how organized are they?
It's very difficult to say how organized they are, because they come from different chapters and different territories from Russia. And some of them are completely violent and untrained. Some of them are panicking, already planning escape routes and how they can desert from the Russian forces. Others are extremely talented and trained and unfortunately very successful at killing Ukrainians and destroying their critical infrastructure. So it is chaotic, and we should also be paying attention currently to large maneuvers of technical equipment coming in from Russia into the Mariupol area.
Is there the worry that the further this gets, the more desperate Russia gets, the more reckless and irresponsible and violent it gets too?
Well, absolutely. And I think that it's important that the Western analysts who are making key decisions understand that there are major weaknesses in a terrified rat that wants to jump out of the corner. And it is up to us to understand how to, do we trap that rat into that corner and keep it there, or do we let it jump out and run around like crazy, which is currently what Russia has been allowed to get away with. If we look at the multidimensional hybrid type of war that Russia has brought onto the global level, ranging from the grain crisis to the energy crisis and the entire planet, not really knowing what's going to happen with the nuclear plant, which they have hijacked in Zaporizhia. So it's a very, very complicated situation, and Russia has gotten away with a lot, unfortunately.
Thank you for your insights, Lara. That was Lara Roslitsky, founder of Black Trident, a defense and security consulting group in Ukraine. It's almost 12:10 here in London. Here is Monaco's Paige Reynolds with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Chinese state media have reported a major fire has broken out in a skyscraper in the central Chinese city of Changsha. The blaze engulfed a tall building that housed an office of state-owned telecommunications company China Telecom. The number of casualties is currently unknown. Iran's president has said that US sanctions must be lifted in order for a new nuclear agreement to be struck. The president added that guarantees need to be established to ensure their lasting removal, and also said that it was not yet time to have face-to-face talks with the United States. Military chiefs from 30 NATO countries will meet in Tallinn today to discuss the new strategic concept agreed at the alliance's most recent summit in June. The aim of the meeting is to shore up the Eastern Front and make NATO better able to respond to Russia. And the summer of disruption continues as London's Heathrow Airport cancels over 100 flights. About 15% of its schedule will be changed on September 19th, the day of the Queen's funeral, to ensure quiet skies during Monday's events. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Paige. Let's then continue with the day's business news. Bloomberg's Euan Potts joins me on the line. Euan, good afternoon to you. Shall we start by looking at what's happening in Germany? Germany's government is being forced to take some dramatic moves to shore up its energy supply. How much do we know at this moment?
Hello, Marcus. Now, Germany has seized the local unit of Russian oil company Rosneft, which includes stakes in three oil refineries. Now, the swoop on the unit is a bit of an escalation of the economic standoff with Russia as Berlin unwinds decades of tight collaboration on energy. The administration pulled the trigger after months of talks. Germany, of course, has been particularly hard hit by the standoff with the Kremlin because of its reliance on Russian gas and oil. Bloomberg has also been reporting that the administration is also in advanced talks to take over Uniper and two other major gas importers. Now, a decision we understand could come within days. The need for action is pretty urgent. Uniper is currently losing about 100 million euros a day as it tries to replace Russian gas and to maintain deliveries to local utilities and manufacturers. We'll get more details on the oil nationalisation plan later today. So far, no comment from the German government on the plan to nationalise the gas manufacturers, the gas importers. On the price action, there is some good news more widely. Natural gas is down again today in Europe. The benchmark European futures currently trading below 200 euros a megawatt hour. At their peak back in late August, they were above 350 megawatt hours. So they've come down quite a lot, those prices, from just a few weeks ago. But they are still very, very elevated for this time of year. But some relief as we head into autumn.
Looking at some other headlines, Euan, why are FedEx shares slumping today?
Yeah, shares in the package delivery giant plunging 20% in pre-market trading today. Now, FedEx has withdrawn its earnings forecast on worsening business conditions. It's flagging weakness in Asia and challenges in Europe. The company also delivered preliminary results for the latest quarter that were well short of forecasts. The company's CEO says that global volumes have declined as macroeconomic trends significantly worsened later in the quarter, both internationally and in the company's home market of the US. Now, the economic data out of the US so far has been pretty mixed, I would say. Employment has been strong, manufacturing also holding up. But some companies starting to paint a slightly more nuanced picture of the economy. These numbers from FedEx really took the market by quite some surprise. It's seen as something of a bellwether for the global economy, as you might expect. When the economy is ticking along nicely, trade is increasing, people send more parcels, more stuff gets shipped around the world. So the fact that FedEx are warning on the outlook is seen as a pretty ominous sign for the global economy. Shares down some 20% today.
Thanks for that update, Euan. That was Bloomberg's Euan Potts, and you are with The Briefing. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Russia's President Vladimir Putin are expected to meet shortly on the sidelines of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit, a regional security meeting in Uzbekistan. A main topic in the discussions will be the deal brokered by President Erdogan to allow grain exports from Ukraine. The Kremlin has repeatedly criticized it. Well, joining me on the line from Istanbul is journalist and regular Monocle 24 contributor Ruth Michelson. Ruth, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Marcus.
So the last time these two leaders met, Erdogan left Putin waiting, shuffling his feet in front of the camera. Do you think the reception will be less frosty this time round?
Well, it's the third time that they've met in recent months. So there's been a lot of contact between the two leaders. The idea is, I mean, the presumption going into this is that Russian and Turkish relations are in some ways at something of a high, given that Turkey has managed to broker the grain deal in July, despite Russia's recent saber rattling against it, and that we're also seeing increasing Russian economic dependence on Turkey because Turkey has refused to join Western sanctions against Russia following the invasion of Ukraine. So relations, despite some of the sort of showmanship of who keeps who waiting, are in general expected to be relatively warm between the two leaders.
So indeed, the grain deal will be the main topic for discussions. What exactly is Russia's problem with it now?
Well, I mean, Putin recently at an economic conference in Vladivostok called the deal a swindle and said, we're seeing another blatant deception, and started talking about how the majority of the grain being exported from Ukraine is going to Western countries that have sanctioned Russia, which is simply not true. It's about 30% at the very most, according to the UN. And so, you know, Erdogan's job today is to essentially convince Putin that this kind of saber rattling, this talk against the deal, these threats towards the deal are counterintuitive, and that Turkey is listening to Russia's interests and can keep it on side. And Erdogan has certainly made some public statements saying that Putin was right to say what he said, and that that perhaps the way forward would be to incorporate grain shipments from Russia and to broaden out the deal that way in order to keep Putin happy.
Do you think we will find out after this day what exactly was being discussed between these two leaders?
Well, if previous meetings or anything to go by, we don't tend to find out what's been discussed immediately afterwards. It tends to sort of trickle out perhaps in the coming days. This is a very carefully stage-managed operation on both sides. So the in terms of what's happening with the grain deal, at a minimum, it's unlikely that at the end of this we're going to see a statement saying that, you know, Putin or Russia is feeling particularly favorable or unfavorable right now towards the grain deal. But what we'll see will be statements in the coming days that give us an indication of how this meeting went and the outcomes of Erdogan's likely interest in persuading Putin to kind of stay on side.
Another topic that may well be discussed is the recent fighting between Armenia and Azerbaijan. What kind of difference could Erdogan make when he talks about this thing with Putin?
Well, Erdogan, in terms of talking about Azerbaijan and Armenia, is very much acting in Turkey's interests there, rather than looking at Russia's interests, which might be a little bit different in the South Caucasus. So Russia is supposed to be guaranteeing the 2020 peace agreement between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And this fighting has reignited at a time when both sides can see that Russia is a little bit perhaps preoccupied with its recent invasion of Ukraine. And for Erdogan, this fighting, or in general, you know, this is an opportunity to expand Turkish influence in the South Caucasus. We've seen that Turkey has increasingly been talking about hosting normalization talks with Yerevan in Turkey. And so Erdogan is looking to expand his influence there at a time when Russia's potentially might be receding.
It's interesting that you mentioned that Russian-Turkish relations overall are at something of a high, considering Russia's increasing economic dependency on Turkey due to these European sanctions. How do Turkish people more widely perceive the fighting, the war that's going on between Ukraine and Russia? How do they feel about Turkey's role in all that?
Well, Erdogan has certainly seized on what's happened as an opportunity to project Turkish power and to project his own power as an international statesman, which is sort of playing the hits, given that Turkey is expected to be heading for an election anytime between now and June of next year. And so, you know, Erdogan has made great effort to show that Turkey is trying to host more peace talks between the two sides if Putin would agree. And he never misses an opportunity to say that he would welcome Zelensky and Putin both to come to Turkey and to have peace talks here. And so for Turkish people, there has been a sense that Turkey has played a major role in what's happening, and certainly with the hosting of peace talks, and that there is also at the same time an overlap with what's happening with the economy. Turkey is having a profound economic crisis. And so there's pressure on Erdogan to heal essentially what's going on, or to play this major role as a way to essentially alleviate some of the pressure on the Turkish economy and keep bolstering his role as a statesman to the Turkish public.
Ruth Michelson in Istanbul, thank you very much for joining us today and have a good weekend. It's 12:21 here in London. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Want to ease into your Saturdays and Sundays in top form? Then tune into Monocle Weekends, where we offer up smart discussion.
If they take the view that newspapers lie to them, that journalists make things up, then they will prefer to believe other people.
The latest from the front pages.
The Neue Zürcher Zeitung am Sonntag is reporting that Switzerland's already set aside 200 million francs.
Magazine tips, plenty of authors.
That gives me the theatre where my characters will act.
And pointers for better evenings on your terrace.
Me, I open more than one bottle because it's easier than just to focus on one bottle.
Join me, Georgina Godwin.
Me, Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
Me, Emma Nelson, from London.
And from Zurich, me, Tyler Brulé. Weekends live right here on Monocle 24.
You are back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Brazilians will head to the polls in the beginning of next month to vote not only on the next president and vice president, but also on the National Congress. The big question is whether the right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro will win a second term, or whether the left-wing former leader Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva will return to the office. Now a new poll trying to predict the outcome is out, and Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me from Sao Paulo. Good morning. Good morning to you, Fernando.
Good morning, Marcus. So yes, indeed, we have a new poll. And I have to say, there's been quite a lot of polling companies, but the one I'm telling you, I would say is probably the most respected. It's from the newspaper Folha de São Paulo. I'll just give you the number so you have a sense how the dispute is. Lula still leads with 45%. It's been a very stable number for a few weeks, in fact. Bolsonaro is at 33%. He's down 1 point compared to the latest one. And we have some minor candidates like Ciro Gomes with 8% and Simone Tebet 5%. So that's how, you know, the race is at the moment.
45% and 33%. It sounds like there's going to be a second round in this election. Do you think there's anything that Lula could do to try to boost the popularity and avoid the second round?
In fact, that's the story here. The race is quite stable. But, you know, of course, some people have this fear. What will Bolsonaro do in a second round? You know, the campaign might become a little bit kind of dirty with some dirty tricks. So what Lula is trying to do is to get some of the votes from Ciro Gomes and Simone Tebet. Because even if half of those votes go to Lula, he does have a chance to win in the first round, which means if he gets 50% or more. And I think that's Lula's strategy. Of course, it can't come across as arrogant, saying, you know, vote for me, because, you know, of course, people like Ciro Gomes or Simone Tebet as well, they're voters. But what Lula is trying to say, that he's the candidate for democracy, for moderation as well, because it must be said, Marcus, yes, Lula is a left-wing candidate, but his vice president belongs to, used to be from the center-right. So I think that's Lula trying to say, you know what, my government will be a government of coalition. It's not just going to be for my worker party members as well.
Fernando, tell me about the mood, the atmosphere in Brazil. Obviously, the nation is rather divided as this election is revealing once again. How tense are these discussions over there? What is the feeling over there?
It is a mix because, Marcus, as you probably know, Brazilians are quite, you know, chatty and friendly, and elections are a big topic. It's almost unavoidable if you go to the hairdresser, if you're in a cab. But at the same time, there was a new poll as well saying that 67% of Brazilians have this fear of being attacked by their political preference. When I say attacked, verbally, physically, in every single way. And I see this tension in the air because I'm very curious. I'm here in Brazil. I want to explore. I want to know what people think. I can see that a lot of people, clearly they know who they're voting, but they're very cautious in how they say, because some people, they get angry. One cab driver was telling me only yesterday that in his cab, he sees a lot of family members fighting, really, you know, and people lose friends. There's been a lot of stories about that. But, you know, to be honest, some other people, they're very open. Yesterday, actually, I went for a beer drink here. And the guy was saying, yes, I'm voting for Bolsonaro. He's the only solution. And funnily enough, you know what he said? Mm-hmm. You know what? He's even going to the Queen's funeral. So, and he is going indeed. And some people say, oh, this is not going to get him votes. Well, maybe not. But for example, this man was clearly impressed about this fact.
Have you been in arguments yourself?
Well, I have to say, in the past, perhaps, but now I'm very moderate. I'm here to listen. You know, some people, even here in Brazil, journalists, I think, to be honest, around the world, in Europe is the same story, but people are very doubtful of journalists. They think we have a secret agenda behind us. So I'm avoiding arguments. I want to listen, even though sometimes it is quite hard to listen to some of the arguments. You know, fake news is a big story, not as big as it was in 2018, I have to say. But some people, they come with this kind of conspiracy theories. That is quite hard kind of not to argue a little bit with that.
Monaco's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco in Sao Paulo. Thanks for joining us and have a good weekend. You are with Monaco 24. And finally in this programme, our own Andrew Miller recaps what we know now that we didn't know 7 days ago.
We learned this week that there are weeks when this taking a wry, sidelong look at the news racket really is a bit of a high wire act, without, if you'll indulge us, any sort of net protecting us should we topple from the thrashing shark tank of outraged public opinion. Such are the risks we run for your entertainment. We learned, or really concluded, when we contemplated our options that we had to pick one from two. The first, which certainly seemed the easiest, was to direct the ensuing few minutes of satirical jocularity away from the obvious and instead make fun of stuff which had no bearing on or relationship to the obvious. We swiftly learned, however, that this was more difficult than it first appeared, as the obvious appeared to be one of those rare news stories so huge that it caused something of an instant drought of other news, because everybody who, in any other week, would have been perpetrating any amount of nonsense, daftness, and folly was inside watching the obvious on television. But it's a tricky business. Morbidly attentive listeners to these weekly monologues will have noticed that last week's did not appear in its regular time slot. A shame, as it really was one of the funniest we'd ever assembled. Indeed, very arguably the funniest 6 or 7 minutes of radio ever recorded in all of human history, and now you'll never know. While it contained nothing obviously subversive or tasteless, not any more than usually anyway, running it in the circumstances just seemed sort of off. for some reason, let's have the chorus of general muttered agreement. The way forward this week, we eventually decided, was to take a series of swings at the fact that nobody else really quite seems to know how to respond either. This, we reckoned, might bring to bear some wintry and fundamentally inclusive humour upon a period of widespread sorrow, mourning, and general discombobulation, and this is obviously by far the more significant consideration, ease us under the radar of those seething witchfinders invigilating against those failing to properly do whatever it is we're all supposed to be doing. And yes, that other chorus is probably overdue at this point.
Come on.
Just get on with it.
So we learned this week that the generally preferred method of showing respect seems to be not doing whatever it is you usually purport to do. And yes, we did have a bit of a think about following this example ourselves, but were concerned that our employers would then have shown their respect by not paying us. Anyway, in not a few cases, if we're honest, and why would we lie, we learned that the connections between the downing of tools and the showing of respect often verged on the outright tenuous. We learned, for example, that Heathrow Airport proposed to show its respect for the late Queen Elizabeth II by cancelling a number of flights, an announcement which will have prompted a great many recent would-be passengers to ponder what else Heathrow has been respecting pretty much all this year. Righto, up and running, reckon we'll get away with this. We learned that other similarly motivated closures and postponements covered the spectrum from the obtuse to the downright recherché. We learned that Norwich City Council had closed a bicycle rack. We learned that Guinea Pig Awareness Week had changed its date to avoid a clash with the elegiac observances, although, ironically, the mockery generated by this announcement marked the first recorded awareness of Guinea Pig Awareness Week. We learned that a well-loved amusement jetty in Southwold had shuttered, possibly submitting to peer pressure. And we learned that perhaps no single entity exemplified the bewilderment of the moment quite as poignantly, if not necessarily deliberately, as Centre Parks, proprietors of holiday resorts for middle-class British or Irish people who cannot be bothered going overseas, and who can blame them what with all the respect British and Irish airports have been showing in recent months. We learned in the first instance that Centre Parks plan to close entirely for 24 hours around this coming Monday's funeral, and we learned very shortly afterwards that this announcement had elicited a mildly riotous response from Centre Parks inmates who were not terrifically keen on interrupting their holidays. Let's have a clip evoking an amount of indignation. We then learned that Centre Parks Crisis Management Division had hit upon the brilliant solution of allowing visitors to remain on the site but stay confined to their lodges, upon which we also learned that it is apparently too soon for the COVID-19 lockdown nostalgia trip. Let's have an even larger amount of indignation. We finally learned that Centre Parks had capitulated to the degree of allowing guests to roam the compound freely, but that nothing would actually be open. It remains unclear to us that any of this, and or the uncountable further such examples, was what she would have wanted. Indeed, during her 7-decade reign, we didn't learn much about what she wanted, which we realise was kind of the idea, but we can at least presume that she might have been quite pleased with the one cohort of Britain that did seem to have some idea how to behave. We learned, because we had the live coverage from Westminster Hall on in the background while we tapped this out, that there's something weirdly affecting about watching an endless queue of random citizenry shuffling silently, curiously, and decorously past the unifying totem of their diverse tribe, the hush interrupted only by the clanking and stomping occasioned by the changing of the guard. A nation which has changed beyond recognition, finding something in communing with an institution which barely changed at all. For Monocle 24, I'm Andrew Muller.
Thank you, Andrew. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Paige Reynolds. Our researcher was Tamsin Howard and our studio manager was Steph Chungu. The Briefing is back on Monday at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening. Have a good weekend.